If you prefer manual, time-consuming processes, then this message isn't for you. But if you want to slash per loan cost and boost productivity, then exploring Indicom's Genius Suite is your next step. Integrate Genius into your operations or pair Genius with Indicom's expert mortgage services for proven ROI. Learn how to get Genius at work by visiting Indicom.com.
Welcome back, Housing News listeners. This is Alcina Lloyd, and I'm the producer of this weekly podcast, which is a proud member of the Industry Syndicate. Today, you'll be listening to the finale of Season 3, which features Angel Oak Mortgage Services Executive Vice President of Production, Tom Hutchins, and Angel Oak Capital's Head of Client Solutions, Manish Flesha. In this episode, the duo help us better understand what is happening in the non-QM landscape, as well as what led to the quick evaporation of the product in March 2020. Additionally, the pair discussed the two newly announced proposed rulemaking notices from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau on the QM patch and what those changes could mean for the housing industry at large. But before we listen, here's a brief word from our sponsor.
A quick message from our sponsor, ArchMI. Lock in ArchMI's most competitive risk-based pricing for your loan with a 90-day promise. Your RateStar quote is automatically guaranteed for 90 days, protecting your pipeline and freeing you to focus on closing the loan. Limitations may apply. Learn more at archmi.com/90-day-promise.
Thanks for listening, and here's the season finale of the Housing News Podcast.
Hey, Housing News listeners, this is Clayton Collins, President and CEO at HousingWire. We're back for another episode of the Housing News Podcast. This is actually going to be the season finale of Season 3 of the Housing News Podcast. Can't believe we've already been through three seasons of this show. And there's just so much happening in the mortgage industry right now. So we're breaking a rule that we usually have of not having repeat guests because there's such an important topic going on right now in the non-QM space. We wanted to bring back Tom Hutchins of Angel Oak, as well as Manish Flesha, the head of client solutions at Angel Oak Capital, to help us better understand what is happening in the non-QM landscape. Tom, Manish, welcome to Housing News.
Thanks, Clayton.
Happy to be back on. I guess if this is the season finale, we need to finish with a cliffhanger, don't we? I'm thinking through that right now.
Bring out the big guns, Tom. So Tom, we had you on the show toward the end of season one. So it's been a little while, and I know a lot has changed in the market, and we've gained some new listeners to the show. So would you mind giving us a quick introduction to yourself and your role at Angel Oak?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Clayton. So as you said, my name's Tom Hutchins. I'm the EVP of production at Angel Oak Mortgage Solutions. And Angel Oak Mortgage Solutions, we have been in the non-QM, non-agency space since 2013. We actually started originating these non-agency loans before the QM / non-QM designation came out. So we were a very early adopter, saw a dislocation of the market post-financial crisis, where, you know, right after the 2008 timeframe, As most people know that are in the industry, the only loans available were agency and government and you know, a little bit of prime jumbo, but not even much of that. So we felt like there was an opportunity to serve borrowers that did not fit those tight agency guidelines. And so we spent, and you know, we've been at this now for 7 years, and it's really just been an education, awareness and education campaign. We grew our business, very rapidly. We really kind of got it into gear around 2014, 2015, then issued securitizations, which Manish can talk more about. We had grown, we exceeded over $3 billion in non-QM originations in 2019. We were expecting to grow that in 2020 to some $5 billion plus. And then came March 2020.
And that is the topic we will dig into. So Manish, welcome as well. I know you represent a different part of the Angel Oak business where you lead client solutions for Angel Oak Capital. Give us a quick introduction to yourself and your role at Angel Oak.
Sure. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on, Clayton. So, I work on the Angel Oak Capital side. My title is Head of Client Solutions. But here at Angel Oak, we sort of have an integrated model working hand in hand with Tom and his team, and actually the end investors in non-QM, the broad range of investors, the pensions, the banks, the insurance companies, the institutional clients that are actually investing in the loans, namely the bonds that are securitized and issued out into the marketplace that are backed by non-QM collateral. So my role really on the capital side is working with that investor base, educating them about what is non-QM, you know, what does our model look like relative to others, and just, you know, sort of educating and generating interest in the end investor base for non-QM.
Excellent. So I want to jump right into the topics. And Tom, if we rewind, and you brought up the topic of March 2020. So I remember the Friday night, I think it was March 20th, our editor-in-chief Sarah Wheeler and I were scrambling to get an article out about what's happening in non-QM. And come Monday morning, it seemed like the market had completely dried up. We had Nations Direct was out, Orion was out, JMAX out, Parkside out, Mega Capital's out, Citadel's out, and Angel Oak all pulling out of non-QM in a very short time period. So what was the market condition that led to that quick evaporation of the non-QM product in March 2020?
Well, you know, that's something that we get asked on a regular basis, Clayton. And, you know, a lot of us have been in the business for a number of years and can remember the financial crisis of the 2007-2008 range. And, you know, what I like to describe to people is that collapse was different in a couple really significant ways. One was that took a while. Like that was a slow, that was a slow occurrence versus this in March. Like you said, it just kind of came upon us. And secondly, the financial crisis was really caused by credit issues, meaning bad loans made to a lot of people. So that was and then, you know, you could go on and on about all the other problems in the whole manufacturing process. But this really came out of nowhere. And the reason that it happened is that, I'll just give you back, you know, we were planning on how to keep managing or running our business remotely. And I think everybody in the US was doing the same thing. But then as soon as states started shutting down businesses, that's when it really got challenging for non-QM, because our loans do not have a government guarantee from a performance standpoint. And it is, so our job is to determine a borrower's ability to repay. But once states shut businesses down, we don't have that ability. We can't, if Texas comes in and just shuts every business down, how do we determine which borrowers in Texas still have an ability to repay these loans that we're doing that are ultimately owned by the investors that Manish is talking about? So as soon as that happened, it not only affected us, like you were naming all the, you know, anyone in the non-agency space had to put a pause on things, because you just can't determine someone's ability to repay. And it was totally, you know, it was out of our hands. But the biggest difference to me was the speed at which it happened. I remember vividly on a Tuesday night in mid-March, everything was good. We were talking about doing some business with, you know, the very next day. And by 8 o'clock the next morning, the market was done. It was over. And of course, that Tuesday was when many states put the clamps down on the business community.
So Manish, from a capital markets perspective, it feels like you look back 12, 13 years to 2008, things started going sour once credit quality started declining. And in this scenario, investors kind of got ahead of the problem and stopped lending before loans became problematic in many scenarios. What did you see? What were you hearing on the investor side? When did people kind of start showing some caution in their appetite for the non-agency product?
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with Tom. It sort of happened very quickly, very abruptly, you know, and it was really more sort of a flight to cash, mm-hmm. More than anything. And, you know, if you look at, you know, some of the data, Like there was a week there, a week ending, you know, March 21st, you had $26 billion of outflows from bond funds. And at the end of the day, the folks that are buying our securitizations are bond buyers. They invest for, you know, their pension plans, for their mutual funds and so forth. And so they were getting redemptions on their end where they had to raise cash as quickly as possible. And really, I mean, it was something, you know, sort of outside of just this sector, outside of non-QM. It was just more broader, the economy where everyone was sort of going to cash as quickly as they could. And at the same time, you know, as Tom was mentioning, you were hearing, you know, news of various states and various businesses just completely shutting down, just having a complete economic shutdown. You know, I think the investor base was kind of reacting to that. And that put sort of a, just, you know, just sort of shut the sector down for a period of time. You know, I will say that, you know, as Tom mentioned, you know, we were very early in this sector. We've spent a tremendous amount of time educating people about non-QM, and, you know, the investor base was sort of, you know, they understood this is not sort of a 2008. These are good quality, good credit loans. And it was something just broader than the sector itself.
Yeah, so you talk about some of the specific loans. I know that self-employed borrowers are a big part of the non-QM borrower base. Were these borrowers for refi or purchase kind of left in the dust? Was there anybody out there that could help them in April, or were the borrowers that traditionally would have been the core Angel Oak client kind of left to wait until the market came back?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and Tom can certainly, you know, add to this, but I think really, you know, those borrowers just lacked mortgage credit availability there for a period of time. And it's not, you know, again, it wasn't just necessarily that segment in particular. I think just broadly, people were just sort of grappling with the idea that, you know, they were sort of shut down from an economic perspective, couldn't go about their day to day. So if you think about non-QM, you know, that self-employed segment is a huge part of what we do. And that segment, you know, effectively lacked credit there for a period of time. And now we're starting to see that sort of change. I don't know, Tom, if you want to add to that.
That's exactly right. It was everyone could see that these small business owners were probably the most heavily affected. You know, mm-hmm. some of the big corporations, they have the wherewithal to survive a shutdown and the capital to survive that, but not necessarily the small business owners, and that is the key, you know, the key driver. So yes, during April, credit availability to those borrowers was almost like 2010. You know, it just wasn't there.
Wasn't there. Well, so I mean, fortunately, it seems like it started coming back. So in May, we started hearing that non-QM lending was inching back in the market, and a handful of companies, including Angel Oak, were starting to come back into the game. What was the economic condition or product iteration that allowed you to come back into the non-agency space? And Manish, maybe you can start us off there.
Yeah, sure. And so Clayton, you know, I think the a large part of that really was kind of this reopening of the capital markets and the idea that, okay, you know, that there was sort of this liquidity backstop put in by the Fed and by the government, you know, really in all sectors of the economy, but you sort of really felt it in the capital markets where the Fed just pumped a tremendous amount of liquidity into the bond market through some of their government programs, TALF and so forth. And it gave folks confidence to get back in and invest. And I mean, you know, you had the Fed lower interest rates quite dramatically, go out and embark on buying securities and putting liquidity back in the system, and sort of at unprecedented levels. And at the same time, you have investors that are investing in non-QM say to themselves, look, I still need to get to my required return on my pension. I still need to get to my required return for my insurance obligations and so forth. So you had those sorts of events take place pretty quickly, actually, and create this demand again for non-QM. And, you know, so all those sort of events happened very quickly, folks realizing that they were going to be in a low yield environment for an extended period of time, yields compressing due to the Fed support. And then, you know, just some of the hard work that we've done over the last few years in educating people about non-QM has created that demand and brought it back to where it is today, and gave us a lot of confidence to go out and originate, look to securitize, and so forth.
So with the Fed buying agency, the Fed now buying corporate bonds, muni yields look terrible. Non-QM kind of became a haven for yield for some of those institutionals.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, look, I think institutions sort of look at things from a relative value perspective, and perhaps maybe non-QM wasn't a direct beneficiary of some of the programs that the Fed and the government really put in place, but it's all a relative value game. So if you have, you know, credit card securitizations come crashing in, well, that's going to have a knock-on effect on non-QM. But I think even more so than just the levels and relative value was the idea that people are starved for yield, they need product, they need the ability to make their liabilities work. And non-QM is a sector where folks have come to realize, look, that these are good performing loans, there's good credit behind them, they've been underwritten properly and appropriately and so forth.
So from a economic metric perspective, is the non-QM investor community watching weekly unemployment like a hawk, or like what are the metrics that like matter most to your investors?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think they're definitely watching unemployment. They're watching the same things that, you know, most folks would in terms of reopening and economic reopening. And again, mm-hmm. you know, the non-QM borrower has traditionally been a self-employed small business owner, where they, you know, they're arguably more susceptible to sort of an income disruption than some of the big corporations, for example, right? Like the Tom's earlier point. So they're watching all those things. They're also watching for origination to sort of, you know, pick back up, because in a sense, you know, some of these big buyers came into this year and said, look, I'm setting aside, you know, a certain portion of my capital budget to be investing in non-QM over the course of 2020. Well, guess what? They're not going to get there. And so there's allocations that need to be met, and they're sort of watching and keeping an eye on new origination and new issuance in the sector to help them get to those targets.
Thank you for listening, and here's a brief word from our sponsor.
During these challenging times, Quicken Loans Mortgage Services is committed to the health and well-being of its partners' clients, and its communities. Even though things are changing rapidly, you can count on the QLMS commitment to speed, certainty, and care. QLMS is now approving new partners within 24 hours. That means you can be up and running quickly and be able to help your clients. Visit qlmortgageservices.com to get started. Now, more than ever, QLMS is stronger together. So Tom, when we think about where we are in non-QM product today, As the market came back in May and now we're in June, what's different about the non-QM product of post-COVID or in COVID versus kind of the pre-COVID days? Are we looking at notable overlays, pricing differences? Like, what's different in the market from a product perspective?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I would tell you we went out of the pause on April 28th. So we came back out actually with a few products, a couple products. That bank statement loan that we talked about, or that everyone's fully aware of, and we also put out an investor loan. We call it our investor cash flow, but it's a DSCR, mm-hmm. borrowers qualify based on the cash flow of the actual underlying collateral. So those are really the two products that we're out there with. I would just say, you know, the credit has gotten tighter and the loan to values have gotten lower. You know, just we've had to clean it up. But the great news is that, you know, we built this for so many years. The return of where we were pre-COVID is going to be a lot more rapid than it was getting to where we were in February. You know, that took 6.5 years. So as the economy and all the things that you and Manish were just speaking of, as that continues to improve, we're going to be able to get really close back to where we were right before COVID. But also, the quality of the loans that we're seeing today from the bank statement borrowers, I mean, think about it. The bank statement borrowers who really made it through the shutdown of the economy and their businesses are still strong, how good is that credit? And mm-hmm. and that's what we're so excited about. You mentioned they were locked out and completely shut down for almost the entire month of April. Very true. But that doesn't mean the borrowers went away. Certainly, everyone was dealing with a lot of different things, personally, financially, business-wise. But those borrowers are still out there. And those that come out on the other side of this pandemic are going to be in a really great position to you know, perform and obtain financing.
Yeah, like similar to what we're seeing in conventional right now, that a little bit of that pent-up demand coming back for a really strong origination launch. Yes. So Manish talked about small business owners and self-employed borrowers a little bit. One of the big topics over the last several months has been the CARES Act and the PPP program. From an underwriting perspective, are you guys looking at, thinking about the small businesses that took PPP? Is that taken into consideration in underwriting as a positive or a negative risk factor, or is that kind of outside the lane?
Yeah, I mean, we look at all of that. Uh-huh. You know, Clayton, there's not one piece that we don't consider. You know, some people took it and it, you know, it helped them get through the shutdown period, and some people didn't. So yes, we are considering everything that's happened in their business since March.
Okay. All right, awesome. So
the other thing, if I could just add, like product wise, one product that hasn't come back yet, but if you think about it, the demand is we also originate in non-QM a lot of deserving borrowers who might have a couple credit blips on their history. But we're thinking as we come through this, there's probably going to be a lot of people that had, you know, they had a bad couple months because their income just got shut down and they didn't have access to PPE and things like that. So we think there's going to be a lot of demand for the full doc borrower, but they're not going to qualify for agency because of some credit hits they took during the crisis.
So as we talk about agency, one of the big stories that came through our newsroom this week is that the CFPB announced on Monday two notices of proposed rulemaking surrounding the QM patch. And one of those rulemakings would remove the DTI requirement from qualified mortgages. And I know this is a story that's been developing since January, since the CFPB director sent a letter to Congress, kind of talking about the CFPB's desire to move away from DTI as an underwriting criteria for the QM product. But this has to have an impact on the non-agency world as the definition of what agency is evolves and is redefined. How is Angel Oak thinking about, and how is the non-QM market thinking about this proposed or pending move away from DTI?
Manish, do you want to talk about that from an investor perspective?
Or? Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the extension there, you know, pushing it out to April 2021 at the earliest, you know, I think just generally sort of everybody sort of think that's a positive development, you know, ensuring that, you know, in this environment that there are no sort of, you know, lack of credit availability and things are sort of, you know, ensure that things will function appropriately given all the uncertainties from an economic perspective and so forth. And, you know, we've been sort of thinking about, the QM patch and the removal of the patch is this tremendous market opportunity for us from a non-agency perspective to step in and originate loans that perhaps maybe once would sort of fall in the agency box, but now would have to come out. And so, you know, that's sort of the general trend that has us excited, and we continue to believe that it'll happen in due course over a period of time. You know, the moving from the DTI threshold to a pricing based threshold, which is what is currently being contemplated. You know, that sort of remains to be seen what the knock on effects are. You know, it's something that was just very recently announced, as you mentioned, Clayton. You know, 200 basis points, you know, our loans typically fall out of that in any event, right? So the question is how much more will sort of come to us. I think that remains to be seen, and it's something we'll be thinking about. But from an overall perspective, having that date being pushed out kind of removes that uncertainty. We sort of would obviously see that as a net positive.
So you have some time to get it figured out. I mean, at face value, it feels like removal of the DTI, which is today the most common reason for a conventional denial, would increase the credit box for agency. But the other components, that pricing component, might actually kind of equal the market out, where you're not in that different of a market size scenario in non-QM.
Well, one thing that I would say, Clayton, is that DTI might come out of the QM, non-QM designation, but it's not going to come out of the determination of a borrower's ability to repay, whether agency or non-agency. So, you know, I don't think that this just means the GSEs are going to throw DTI out and they're just going to, hey, DTI doesn't matter because your APR is 3.5%, so you get a loan. I think it's really just that designation is what's going to be, you know, that's what's going to change. And then same for us on the non-QM side. It has always been important. And, you know, the relationship that we have with Manish and Angelo Capital and our end investors is that we're on the non-QM side, we're going to always produce quality loans. That is kind of the key ingredient for this whole thing working. So DTI will always be a major consideration for us when it comes to making or not making a loan for someone. So that's, you know, how it's determined at the, you know, kind of the patch level, if you will, is one thing, but I have not seen it being a huge impact on the actual credit decisioning, whether it's agency or non-agency.
Okay. Well, it seems like that Angelo has remained pretty bullish on the future size of the market and opportunity. I know a few weeks ago, you were vocal about preparing for an increase in non-QM borrowers after the pandemic and an Angelo 2.0 strategy. And that is about all I know about Angelo 2.0. So tell me, what is Angelo 2.0 and what are you excited about when it comes to the increase in non-QM in the coming months or years?
Well, I think a couple things. One is that the need for non-agency, whether we call it non-QM, you know, the need for non-agency, it really never goes away. You know, the GSEs were not, their charter is not to give every single borrower in the United States a loan. So they're always going to have guidelines. So you know, whatever the percentage of those that fall out that are still, you know, still have that ability to repay a loan, it's always going to be there. It's going to be 5% of the market, 10%, 50%, you know, we don't know that level, but certainly we're excited about it because really the foundation that we built over the last 6+ years, we've gone through the education. People know what non-QM is, and non-QM 2.0, we'll have to talk about maybe some of the changes and the differences, but we don't see that lasting a very long time because we had a vertically integrated from origination to securitization. We had that platform built successfully, and it was, you know, it was really clicking on all cylinders and growing tremendously. So we just think the period of us getting back to that point is just going to be, you know, a lot shorter than it certainly was when we started from scratch.
So it sounds like the investor demand comes back pretty quickly. Tom, on in your interactions with your origination channels, are you seeing the originator's ability to kind of turn back on their non-QM pipelines and bring that demand back into the market at a relatively similar speed as the investor demand is coming back?
Well, you know, there have been a lot of originators that have made non-QM a part of their everyday offering. You know, they've built even maybe a name, a reputation in their market as, hey, I'm that self-employed expert, or I'm that, you know, the person that falls out, you call me. And they've built their business around that, and we're having a lot of success. The only thing that's changed really, though, is that we do have record refinance agency activity. So almost every originator is busting at the seams, right? So they don't necessarily have to originate non-QM today in order to close loans in June 2020. But they already understand the importance of having more than just Fannie and Freddie in their back pocket. And that's the answer is yes, we see it, but everyone is really busy in the mortgage business right now.
So another huge topic that we've been watching closely at Housing Wire, and we keep hearing from our readers more information on, is jumbo. And it seems like in a very similar way that investor demand kind of weaned away from non-QM for a period, that same investor demand entirely backed away from the jumbo market. Manish, in your purview in capital markets, do you have any exposure to investor interest in the jumbo market? Are there any similarities to the risk profile that investors perceive in with non-QM?
Yeah, I mean, look, we don't have, from an investor perspective, we don't have a tremendous amount of exposure there to jumbo. I will say that, you know, some of the early things I said do hold true in terms of, you know, folks coming back into the market looking for yield. But I would say this, like, you know, at least as it pertains to non-QM, just to build on one of Tom's earlier points is, you know, one of the questions we always used to get and sort of the issue really was, you know, having non-QM go through some sort of stress test. And, you know, having gone through a period like this, you know, you can say non-QM has had a stress test. And frankly, the mortgage market 2.0 has gone through a stress test. And so, you know, as you think about coming through the other side of this, whether it's jumbo, whether it's non-QM, you know, investors can look and say, okay, you know, my bonds did perform, my bonds did, you know, not trip triggers and not shut off cash flows. You know, that's very critical, and that continues to build on the demand that we've worked so hard to create with the asset class in non-QM, and I'm sure it's applicable in prime jumbo as well, which is having the idea that, okay, you've gone through a stress test, you've seen what the performances look like, and this is, you know, something that you build in into your thought process in terms of investing in the sector going forward.
Excellent. Manish, Tom, thank you both so much for your time today. Really appreciate sharing your expertise and knowledge and keeping us updated on everything that's happening in the non-QM world. Housing News listeners, that's a wrap for season 3. We'll see you next time.
Well, listeners, that's a wrap for season 3. And just because the season's done doesn't mean you can't re-listen. If you do, please don't forget to give us feedback and rate us on iTunes. Also, make sure to check out HousingWire's latest podcast, The Daily Download, which is a daily wrap of HousingWire's hottest stories, now available on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcast, and more. Until next season, we'll see you then.